No problem. Thank you, man. I'm a big fan.
Thanks, man. Yeah, that's not an out west voice. That's a
we black around here. This is out north voice.
We are north. Oh.
From Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm Debbie Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Karthikeya Kundabolu. Karthikeya is my middle name, so Hari was my parents doing me a favor.
We're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
That doesn't always mean talking to politicians and activists. It can mean talking about the politics of everyday life.
You mean like everyday racism?
Yeah.
Like at the mall?
Sure.
At work?
Most likely.
In a parking lot in Omaha, Nebraska?
Oh, hi, yeah, that's my Mini Cooper. Guy goes, what? And he goes, that's your car. And he goes, hold on a second. And I go, oh, no.
That's Lacey Lamar, co-author of You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism.
She wrote the book with her sister, former Late Night with Seth Meyers writer-performer and star of the Amber Ruffin Show on Peacock, Amber Ruffin.
We create a safe space for people to explore their racist tendencies, but it'll get your ass in a book.
The book is jammed with racist incidents from Lacey's life in Omaha, Nebraska. Some big, some small, but when taken together...
I get it when how people want to say microaggression, but like the 100th microaggression is what stabs you and what makes you want to flip a table.
We'll talk about what it was like living through 2020 as a black woman in Omaha.
And also as the brand new host of a late night network talk show who also just happens to be a black woman.
But before we talk to Amber and Lacey, we'll talk to one of the country's leading lawyers, Georgetown law professor and former acting U.S. Solicitor General, Neil Katyal.
Neil is currently leading the team prosecuting Officer Derek Chauvin for the killing of George Floyd, which, due to a gag order, he can't talk about no matter how much we asked. But we did talk about a lot. Why he chose to challenge the constitutionality of Guantanamo Bay, how Merrick Garland will handle the prosecutions from the invasion of the Capitol, and what it's like to make an argument in front of the Supreme Court.
It's much more like a conversation than it is like an argument. Like, if you go in like, my points are this, they get laughed out of there.
We'll also talk with Neil about why affirmative action is worth defending and how the right has tried to make it a wedge between Asian Americans and Black and Latino Americans.
I mean, it's the British strategy with, you know, with Pakistan, man. It's divide and conquer.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. I delivered it differently. You like it? Come out. I delivered it.
I don't like it when you do that line. That's my line.
Okay. Well, you always do that line, so I thought I would do it. I affirmatively acted.
Oh. Don't put a wedge between us.
Hey, man. How are you?
Living in America.
Do you want to start out with some happy news? Should I give you some happy news?
Sure, let's do happy news.
Baby is sleeping without the swaddle.
Wow. These are the markers of a growing child.
Yeah. He doesn't need to be bound to be asleep now. I don't need to bind him to his crib. Sometimes he wakes up and he's like, "What? Why am I not bound? Yeah. Oh my God, I'm not bound." And he just starts screaming and his arms and legs start flailing and then you have to calm him down.
It's funny that you describe it as bound, because in our house we called it baby burrito, which I think sounds friendlier.
Well, I mean, my personality and your personality, I think
Much. Well, I think Melissa's the one who came up with the baby burrito, to be honest. But but you're bound, because honestly, I would keep my kids wrapped in a burrito even now, just because it would help them go to sleep faster. But yeah, these are the markers of a growing child. Congratulations, your child is growing.
It's big. It's big. Joss's mom is here. She'll be here for another week. She's a pediatrician, so that helps, man. That helps.
Yeah. If it didn't help, it'd be weird. If she was like, I don't know nothing about taking care of this kid, or I'm not interested, which are some grandparents, but good.
No, we were very lucky. So, yeah, it's a huge, huge progress.
It's funny how your relationship to your in-laws changes after you have kids, and it all swings on how good they are with your kids.
Is that really?
Like, I mean, I feel like this, like... I had a whole newfound appreciation specifically for Melissa's mom, because she's the, like, get on the floor, make an art project grandmother.
Yeah.
My mom is not that. So I love my mom, but she's also a little bit older, but she also is just not that. When I was a kid, my mom said, I hate playing Candyland. Hey. But what are you talking about? But I'm eight. Let me enjoy Candyland.
Did she actually say that?
Yeah, I have a very visceral memory of my mom letting me know she did not like Candyland. So.
I like your mom even more now.
In other news about America, they're working on passing the $1.9 trillion coronavirus package.
Good thing nobody needed that money over the last 3 or 4 months, huh?
Yeah, good thing we can all just sort of wait on people who need that money can just wait. They can just wait. Oh, I'll just tell my landlord, my stomach, my medical issues to just wait until that
soup again. Yummy.
Yeah, I'll just tell. Yeah, they're passing it, and there's all the negotiations. So at first, that group of ten Republican senators went to Joe Biden's office and were like, "We would like it to be less," and he was like, "Nope, see you later. Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you." Then, so it's like, yay, Joe Biden's playing tough and da-da-da. Well, now, but as you said last week, Joe Biden had said that the $15 minimum wage is not going to pass. He's like, we're putting it in there, as you talked about. And I thought, oh, that's bad, but at least we're going to give it a shot. Well, last week sometime, I found out somebody works in the Senate who I had no idea existed.
Yep.
The Senate parliamentarian.
When I first heard the word parliamentarian, I'm like, oh, that's the Star Wars show with the Baby Yoda.
The parliamentarian.
No way a parliamentarian exists in America in 2021. Yeah, this isn't the 1700s. The British didn't stay.
I thought they left all that stuff behind, but apparently they brought one Senate parliamentarian with them. And that parliamentarian, her name is Elizabeth McDonough. She's an unelected, quote-unquote, nonpartisan interpreter of chamber rules, commonly referred to as the Senate referee. I'm reading from an NPR article about it. She nixed a Democratic push to add a $15 an hour federal minimum wage increase to President Biden's coronavirus relief package because, she said, it did not meet the strict requirements of reconciliation. Basically, it allows things to pass without the filibuster, which we've talked about before. And the thing with reconciliation, the only thing you can put in it is things that that affect the budget, like the actual budget of the country. So I've heard many people argue that, of course, a minimum wage affects the budget of the country, because if people have more money and they spend more money, it will affect the country's budget. So, yes, but she's saying, un point of order. She pushed her glasses back up on her nose, and she probably did that thing where she pulled her mask down to talk closer to people. I'm just sort of riffing now. I don't know. Right. And she said that we're not allowed to do that.
The idea that she's unelected, tricky. Yes. I mean, I guess in some ways it's good that both sides agree, okay, we need some kind of representative to explain this to us. But it also annoys me because then you have all those people who say we should be interpreting this the way it was intended and written so many years ago. Hey, Elizabeth, what does it mean? You don't even know what it means, which means you can change it, that you don't need to stick to it. Also, this is another example of how the Democrats play by the rules because they're a bunch of dummies. They're saps. Because Trent Lott apparently had a similar situation. It was 2000. It was the Bush era tax cuts.
Yeah.
The parliamentarian said, "No, sir, you cannot do that. You cannot."
The parliamentarian took off his put down his snuff box and repowdered his wig and said, "Sorry, good gentleman.
That is not allowed." And Trent Lott's like, "You're fired."
And move, that's, nerd.
Because the rules don't mean anything. Fuck it. Get somebody who agrees with what I believe in. And the Democrats now were like, but the rules, though.
Trent Lott pushed the Senate parliamentarian into his locker, locked it, and went on about his business.
Right.
Couple things. So one, apparently, as you said, Kamala Harris could just say, "Now we're not doing that. Thanks, referee. Kamala Harris is not doing that," which means now people on the left are mad at Kamala Harris, which is, again, it's that weird thing about now we're mad at the woman of color, but I also understand, come on, Kamala Harris, but you could just say. And also, this is the part that I think really made me go, the person who's deciding that they will not raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour makes $171,000 a year.
Ah!
So to me, that is what is called a conflict of interest, as far as I'm concerned, because I guarantee you The federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And the minimum wage has not tracked with inflation. It has not met the cost of living. And if you work in some states where the tipping wage is $2.13 an hour. So, I mean, there are people in this country who are working for $2.13 an hour, and it's legal. There are people working for less than that, but it's not legal. But there's people working for $2.13 an hour, and it's legal. I guarantee you that if the Senate parliamentarian was being paid the tip wage and was making money based on tips, they might be like, I think $15 an hour is a pretty good idea. I think I found a clause where that's okay in the parliamentarian strictures.
Does anybody else find it weird, too, that like all these representatives and senators, they like vote for pay increases for themselves on the regular, but when it's about like raising minimum wage for the country, that's where like, oh, there's going to be all sorts of implications and economic this and that. It's like, fuck you. Like, and like someone you're fine with you getting as much as you need to get, but for people to be able, 15 an hour isn't that great to begin with. Like No.
15 an hour just gets people closer to zero. Like it gets people like it doesn't like 15 an hour. Like there's been all these different reports. Some reports say the minimum wage should be over $20 an hour. Some say it should be around 15, but definitely 15 is not like some sort of like magical number where everybody suddenly has yachts and fainting couches. Let's be clear about that. Right. And as somebody who I know you never had a real job, Hari.
That's not true. I had a real job for several years.
What was your job?
I was an organizer.
Oh, okay. That sounds like working at McDonald's.
It's true. He's right.
I literally, my first job in high school, I was making $3.35 an hour.
Oof.
Because that's what the minimum wage was. And I am very old, but we're talking about like the late 80s, I think I was making $3.35 an hour. And then but they bumped me up to $3.50 before my first paycheck because I really impressed. People walk into stores, and I say this is my experience, and wonder why the employees are being salty or why the employees aren't giving them great service or blah, blah, blah. A friend of mine told me a great story years ago that his boss, it was like a bookstore with a coffee shop. And in the coffee shop part of the bookstore, they had like the pastries. At the end of the day, they would throw out the pastries unless the employees wanted them. Then they would sell them to them for 50% off.
What? They would sell? What are you talking about?
So they would either throw them away, but if you want them, they're 50% off. That's how minimum wage jobs work. They give you a bad attitude because of things like that. They force you to have a bad attitude because you're not being paid anything, and then they're also nickel and diming you about things. If you give people a living wage, people's attitude about their work becomes better. Mm-hmm. People's pride in their work becomes different. But when you are paying them the least you can pay them, and that wage is not a living wage, you're forcing people to get extra jobs, and you're forcing them to not give a shit about your job because it feels insulting. And I'm not saying there aren't minimum wage workers who don't have pride in their job. I'm not saying everybody knows the coffee shop where all the workers are shitty except for that one who's always like cleaning the counters. But I'm saying generally it's a problem. And if you pay people a living wage, their work gets better. The productivity gets better. You don't have so much workers turning over because they're like, I'm going to try to get a job that pays me a nickel more than this job. The whole economic system gets better if people are paid a true living wage.
This is the responsibility of the government to make sure people have their basic needs met. If you are working, which this country says like everyone should have a job, everyone should work. Well, people are working and that's still not enough to survive. Like, what's that famous Chris Rock joke from his first album? He says that minimum wage means that if I could pay you less, I would.
Yes. there's always a Chris Rock quote, it turns out. Yes, yeah. Because it's not a good society if people don't have their basic needs met. It creates what we have now in the middle of the pandemic. Like, the bottom is falling out of society, and the rich are getting richer.
People are upset at the idea of, I mean, because there are people who are upset at a $15 minimum wage. It's gonna destroy all these small businesses, And meanwhile, it's like, do you realize what these tax cuts have done? Do you realize like how rich people hide their money? And and you're worried about like, and these poor people are getting another check and they're getting $3 more. Like, what are you fucking worried about?
And meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren is proposing a wealth tax on people who are worth $50 million and $1. People who are worth $50 million and $1. A tax of 2 cents on the dollar for every dollar that you're worth over $50 million. And then like several cents up to a billion. And then over a billion, like a few more cents for every dollar. And that is going to be fought tooth and nail by the same people who said $15 minimum wage is too high.
If we stopped agreeing with these motherfuckers who make exactly, over $50 yeah. million, dollars, they would be outnumbered.
And they're also, many of them are very old and frail, so they wouldn't put up a good fight.
I mean, that's the thing about the 1%. That means that we have the numbers. We're just choosing not to do anything about it. But what if I made the 50 mil? What if I, if I finally get to 50 million by the time I'm 110, then what?
Yeah, then I got to pay 2 cents on the dollar. And this is the thing the Democrats also don't get. Even Republicans who hate you would be happy to have a $15 minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And you'd actually start to pull some of those Trumpers away who were at CPAC coughing with their masks off. You would even start to get some of those people, some of those working white Americans you're so worried about, would go, I'm going to go with the people who made my pocketbook better. So,
I mean, there's fucking Trumpers who hate Obamacare, love the ACA. Yeah. They don't know. They just know this thing is good. They just don't like Obama because they're racist. Yeah. But this has nothing to do with the actual policy.
Yeah. Call it the Trump wage, and then we can...
Right. That'll get done. But come out. Good thing Bernie Sanders didn't get elected, because then nothing would get done. Nothing would get done then. Come on. Nothing would get done. People would be... All he would do is talk about the rights of the working class and everyone having health care. Nothing would get done.
Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about, I don't know how to segue out
happy
of that
news.
Rant.
Is there any more happy news? Let's get
there is happy news. That's a good thing. There is happy news. We're bookending this like the compliment sandwich where you say a nice thing, then a hard thing, then a nice thing. So this is the happy news in the middle of the shit sandwich that is this country. You all hear at the end of the credits, you hear me thank Brontez Purnell for the music on the show. I just want to let you know that in addition to being an incredible musician, Brontez is also a dancer, a director, and a writer. And currently, he's got two projects out that we want to let you know about so you can check them out. He's got a new novel that's getting a lot of positive reviews. It's called 100 Boyfriends. You can buy that wherever you buy books, support an independent bookstore in your neighborhood or in your town or in your city or online. And he's got a new EP out that is called White Boy Music that got a glowing review in Rolling Stone from Billy Joe Armstrong. Brontez is from Oakland. Billy Joe is from Oakland. So it's some Oakland on Oakland love. You can check it out wherever you get music. I listen to it on Spotify. It's like three songs. It's really fun to listen to. So yeah, support people who have done good work for this show like Brontez Purnell.
I'm really looking forward to talking to Amber Ruffin and her sister Lacey Lamar about their new book, You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism. That it's a fun interview. The both of them obviously have incredible chemistry. So honestly, I don't think we really had to be there. I think they could have done it without us.
No, I think Lacey could have done it by herself. I'm going to produce Lacey's talk show. She's got new Oprah vibes. And before we do that, we're going to talk to one of the country's leading lawyers, Neil Katyal, about affirmative action, the Supreme Court, and prosecuting the January 6th insurrectionists.
Let's get this going. Neil Katyal is one of this country's leading litigators and legal minds.
He's Saunders Professor at Georgetown Law and former Acting Solicitor General of the United States. He's argued more than 40 cases before the Supreme Court.
Neil also leads the team of pro bono attorneys working with Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison to prosecute former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for third-degree murder in the killing of George Floyd.
But because of the judge's gag order, we couldn't go into that case, but we covered a lot of ground anyway. Let's talk to Neil.
Neil, thank you so much for joining me and Kamau on Politically Reactive.
Thanks, man. It's great to be here with you. I'm such a fan of yours, so it's really an honor to be with you.
I mean, it's an honor for us to interview you, but you know, there's something that's always bittersweet when I talk with such accomplished Indian Americans like yourself or Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, because there's a great deal of pride that I feel, right? The fact that you've done the incredible things you've done. And at the same time, I can imagine my parents' feelings as they look at you and think of what could have been. And that's a little bittersweet.
I get that. But, you know, I look at you and I have the same feelings of pride, too. And I will say, you know, all of us are now eclipsed because, man, Kamala Harris, we're all screwed. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, you're only a phenomenal film producer and writer and so on, or only a pretty good lawyer. You know, you could have been vice president.
Right.
You know,
right.
And if her mom, who sounds like an amazing character, but if her mom were alive, she'd probably say, you know, vice president?
First question I have for you, I mean, it's kind of a silly question, but you've argued in front of the Supreme Court so many times. What does it actually feel like to argue in front of the Supreme Court? Does it look like any other courtroom? Is it huge? Are they, I always imagined them on a platform. Are they on a platform? Like, is, are there tons of speakers so you can,
I
hear
imagine
yourself?
The white wigs from like the, from like the UK. Okay.
All right. There are no wigs. There is a platform. And, you know, it's a courtroom unlike any other in America that I'm aware of, because you're really close to the justices. You're about 10 feet away from the Chief Justice, and then the other eight are spread out about 30 feet in either direction. So you actually can't see all nine, even if you have great peripheral vision when you're arguing. So you can see about five or six. There's one set of speakers and they're overhead. It's much more like a conversation than it is like an argument. Like if you go in like, my points are this, you get laughed out of there. If instead you really treat it like you're around the dinner table and they're asking you hard questions and you're trying to facilitate the best answer you can, those are the best arguments. And you know, the justices often haven't talked to each other much about the case before they get in. And so the questions they're asking you, sometimes they're actual questions for them, but a lot of times they're questions that they're making to the other justices. They're points that they're making, and they're trying to persuade one another sometimes. And you're just the ping pong ball in the middle, facilitating that dinner time conversation. It's very different than other courts. I mean,
yeah, that sounds incredibly passive aggressive.
I wouldn't say necessarily passive aggressive, but I will say it does really work as a search for truth. Like, I'm going to talk about the pre-COVID argument because coronavirus has changed everything at the Supreme Court. But you really would, through this throwing questions at the advocate one after another, really expose the weaknesses in someone's argument, and also the kind of logical limits of it. Because the Supreme Court, when they take a case, they don't take it because of the individual facts. They're taking it to make a general law for the country. And as such, they are worried about what the contours of any legal rule they write might be and what unanticipated consequences might there be. So the argument's trying to get at that, and the justices will pile one on another, asking an advocate those questions. With coronavirus, it's totally different. Like, you get 3-minute question rounds, each justice taking a turn. And you get a 2-minute opening where they don't interrupt you. Normally, the justice interrupted me within like 10 to 15 seconds. I'd write down like one line on a legal pad, hope I could say it before they would ask me a question. But now it's totally different.
As someone who has argued so many times before the Supreme Court, there's a lot of talk of court reform. Full disclosure, I work with a group called Talking About Court Expansion, Take Back the Court. As someone who argues before the Supreme Court, do you think it works as it is currently set up? And is that a question you can answer?
Well, look, I think there's so much that does work about the Supreme Court, because unlike the other branches of government, which tend to, you know, particularly the last 4 years, been disastrous, at least you can come in and make an argument to the court, and they won't just always view it through a political lens. So, for example, there's a really hard question last year, big question about whether or not Title VII, which prevents discrimination because of sex, does that protect gay people and transgender people? And the conservatives, states and employers said, no, of course not. Because of sex, that was written in 1964 as part of the Civil Rights Act. Nobody thought they were protecting gay people or transgender. Indeed, that was considered a, you know, psychiatric illness or something like that. That's what they said. And what many of the conservatives on the Supreme Court said, including Neil Gorsuch, who wrote the opinion siding with the gay and transgender employees, they said, the plain text says discrimination because of sex. You know, when you fire someone for being gay or transgender, that's firing them because of sex. You know, if they're, you know, and so as a result, he said, these people are protected. You know, I don't often see a result like that in the political branches, but I do sometimes see it at the court. Now, having said that, I think that the Republicans and Mitch McConnell have done a tremendous disservice to the country by playing the shenanigans that they played with the Supreme Court. And it is reprehensible. It's wrong. It's actually evil in my book. You know, not giving Merrick Garland a hearing in 2016. Mm. You know, I think the world saw last week just what kind of amazing jurist Merrick Garland would have been. What a deep human. He's a guy who's the chief judge of our nation's second highest court for 20 years. Never been overruled by the Supreme Court in 20 years. Just really a kind of legend. And to have deprived Americans of that, I can't get my mind around a worldview in which you just care so much about the win and the scalp that you don't think about what's right. Like you, I do think that a price should be paid. It's not right what's happened. It's not right that they rushed Justice Barrett through with like 6.2 minutes before the presidential election. You know, regardless of what you think about her, that's not the issue. The issue is what happened to this process. And, you know, it's fundamentally broken because one party cares a lot about the courts and will do anything to break it just in order to get more people of their own on. And the other party just doesn't care. When I was in the Obama administration, I kept on saying, circuit courts, this is your legacy. You know, those are the courts of appeals, the nation's second highest courts. You know, couldn't get much traction.
What are your thoughts on court expansion?
Well, first, I think that, you know, we think about the lower courts, which President Trump has packed with a bunch of incredibly ideological people, particularly at the district court level. And so you get these people who literally told the Senate Judiciary Committee they won't say Brown versus Board of Education is rightly decided.
Wow.
I mean, those are our jurists. Those are the people who are hearing cases day in and day out right now. So I'm very worried about that. And I do think that more judges is an appropriate response, not just to that, but to the fact that there's still long delays in the justice system. I think that's also true at the Court of Appeals. At the Supreme Court, I think it's tough because if the Democrats could get the votes to expand the Supreme Court, then what would happen, you know, let's say they, and I think if they did, you know, they don't go to 11, I think they go to 13 or 15. But if they go, if the Democrats go to 13 and the Republicans win in 2028, they'll go to like, you know, 19 or 21. And then the Democrats win in 2032, it'll go to like 47. And it's frankly going to be like India with like 100 justices on the Supreme Court. And that's not good either. So I think that it's a really tragic situation because, and again, I really do feel like most Democrats, were they, and certainly the ones I revere, were they in power, they would have never played these games with the Supreme Court and put everyone in this position.
Isn't part of the problems here like that there are factions of the right, and that faction is leading the right now, as we know from CPAC this weekend, where Trump got 55% of the straw poll, that they're not going to argue in good faith any issue. Whereas the left is always trying to assume good faith in the arguments. Like when I think about the Supreme Court and I say, this person's an originalist, this person's a this, and it's like, well, it seems to me that everybody's sort of taking what they personally believe and then finding a frame for it that they can say, no, this is why I'm saying that.
Politically, there are people on the left as well as people on the right who just actually have no principles and they'll just say anything, and raw power is the ultimate aim.
But isn't with the left, aren't those people generally like hanging out at the flea market?
Well, exactly. That's what I was about to say, is that the difference is that the conservatives, that is the those are the people in power. And yeah, for our guys, yeah, they're the ones at the flea market. So it's not.
No shade to the flea market, everybody. I'm just saying that like the left's most radical people are not in the in the positions of power generally.
Exactly. And so I think we've got that disparity, which is why you had, for example, the Trump folks have so much momentum to pack the courts with extreme ideologues. And the Democrats, when they come in, they assume good faith and they're like, let's have a conversation about this nominee. If you don't like this one, who else would you suggest? And, you know, we'll be happy to take a look at that and, you know, and serve them tea and biscuits. And so, you know, I do think that there's a fundamental difference in the left, particularly those in power, have unilaterally disarmed, particularly when it comes to the courts.
Neil, one of the major reasons we wanted you on today is because you've argued cases regarding affirmative action. And it's a subject actually we've wanted to talk about for a while on the show, and we've never actually gotten to. And we felt like you definitely were somebody who was very knowledgeable, especially with what's happening now. the idea of affirmative action was initially introduced by the Kennedy administration. So what was it supposed to be originally, and how is it kind of transformed?
Well, I think affirmative action, you know, is right now, obviously, a very hot issue. The Harvard case has just been brought to the Supreme Court. I represent Yale. And there, in the case that the Trump administration filed against them, which Biden just dropped a couple weeks ago, and now a conservative student group, the same one suing Harvard, sued Yale last week as well. You know, affirmative action historically has had two different rationales. One is kind of the compensatory rationale, which fell out of favor for most of our upbringing, but that's the idea that African Americans and others have been discriminated against in the economic system. There's a legacy of slavery, all sorts of stuff. And as a result, we should compensate for that by giving them certain preferences. And the Supreme Court in 1978 basically threw a lot of cold water on that idea in a case called Bakke. And what they said is, it's one thing if you want to give preferences in order to diversify a student body where it could benefit everyone because Caucasians could learn from African Americans in the classroom and vice versa. It's another thing if you're doing it to try and make up for past discrimination. As the Supreme Court later said in a case in 1995 about contractors, they said, there's no logical stopping point. How many preferences do you give if you're giving it in the employment context? And so for that reason, it's always been harder in employment and easier in the university setting. And frankly, the university setting is really largely what's left.
Can you talk to us about the details of the Harvard case as well as the Yale case, as well as the organization that kind of has pushed these cases forward, the one led by Edward Blum?
Yeah, it's called Student for Fair Admissions. And because, you know, they're, you know, ongoing litigant against me, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about them. You know, I'll say what I say in court. And in general, my attitude is I respect organizations that test the limits of the law. I think that's important. You know, it bothers me when people go and attack the lawyers for bringing cases because, you know, if you don't like the result of a decision, you know, I get that. But attacking the lawyers always just struck me as a really weird way to do some, you know, some sort of, you know, make society better. Because, you know, people attack me for Guantanamo to no end.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
The Supreme Court's 2006 ruling in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld was a landmark. It invalidated the system George W. Bush set up to try accused war criminals at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And it's widely seen as one of the most important rulings on executive power ever. It was also the first argument Neil Katyal ever made before the Supreme Court. He was in his mid-30s and teaching law at Georgetown and was an early critic of the Bush military tribunals.
Neil volunteered as a civilian lawyer on the military defense team when Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift was appointed counsel for a Yemeni citizen, Salim Amen Hamdan, who'd served as Osama bin Laden's driver. But that appointment had a catch. Access to his client was conditioned on negotiating a guilty plea. Katyal drafted a legal document for Swift to take with him for the first meeting with Hamdan. Hamdan said he didn't want to plead guilty and authorized a legal challenge on his behalf.
When he made his first visit to Guantanamo, Hamdan asked him why he was working on the case. Neil told him that his parents came to America for one reason. America doesn't treat people differently because of where they come from. We fought a civil war in part about the idea that all people are guaranteed certain rights, and chief among those is the right to a fair trial.
Hamdan versus Rumsfeld took 3 years to work its way through the courts, during which time Hamdan remained in solitary confinement and deteriorated emotionally and physically.
Neil devoted thousands of hours to preparation. He made a list of the lawyers across the country who intimidated him the most and then flew out to do dry runs in front of them. It all paid off on June 29, 2006, with Neil and Swift in the courtroom, when the Supreme Court sided with the defense on almost every point.
I had to have bodyguards and all sorts of stuff, and it was horrible. And, you know, I get that. Passions are very strong. But at the end of the day, these are decisions made by justices, and, you know, go and criticize them if you don't like the decision. So I don't have any problem with people bringing cases. I have problems with what the cases are sometimes. The Harvard case is one in which the strategy has been, and I suspect, you know, maybe this will be true in the Yale case, it's just been filed, so we'll see, but to take the Asian American community and make them kind of this wedge and say, affirmative action used to be African-American versus white. Now it's about this other thing. It's about Asians being discriminated against. And the data, you know, generally never bears this out. I mean, I'm very familiar with the Yale data in which Asian-American admittees are, you know, are incredibly high. So I think that oftentimes there's a mountain made out of a molehill in these cases. I understand it can be, you know, good for an organization's profile. It can be good for fundraising and stuff like that. But you got to prove up that, you know, Asian Americans are truly being discriminated against. And, you know, so far as the Court of Appeals, and I think a 100-plus page opinion in the Harvard case said, you didn't prove it up. With the admissions programs that I've studied, I'm actually really impressed by how it operates. And I've been in classrooms. I teach criminal law, and I once taught a class that had, out of 80 people, one African-American in the class. How do you teach the Bernie Goetz case about self-defense? How do you teach, you know, police brutality cases like Huey Newton without having people who have that perspective? And it's just, it is an impoverished discourse in the classroom if you don't have true diversity. And by the way, I think true diversity in good affirmative action programs isn't just race. It's class, it's religion, it's geography, it's, you know, extracurriculars, great flute players, or, you know, Olympic fencers or whatever. I do think that's how it tends to operate in the places that I've studied.
Is part of the problem with the United States is that there's not like a legal standard of racism. Like there's not like that it is something that is our certainly a force. It's an economic force. It's a social force. It's a cultural force. It is something the country was built on, this crime of racism. But there's not a way for the law to go, that's racist. So there's a lot of way to tear apart ideas and programs that are trying to end, that are trying to dismantle racism.
It's such an interesting perceptive question because, you know, I don't know if it's a definition of racism, but it's something like that, in which it's actually hard for us to get our minds around racism because it pervades so much of our thinking and we're so unconscious about it. You know, I have a colleague at Georgetown, Chuck Lawrence, who started writing about this in like 1987. And honestly, you know, I think of myself as a pretty open-minded guy, but it took me many reads of his work to really get it, this idea that a lot of racism is not conscious. It's stuff that is the byproduct of a system. And that's very hard to get a consensus around. It's very hard to even talk about, because then you're accusing everyone of being a racist. And, you know, and then you get the ridiculousness on the other side, like Donald Trump saying, I'm the least racist person ever. You know, I think the insight that Chuck have had, and now there's so much phenomenal work being done on this, is that we all have some of these attitudes in us. And it's a real problem when a system magnifies them, whether it's giving a cop a gun, whether it's, you know, giving a bank the opportunity to, you know, turn people down on loans, or employers, you know, turning people down, you know, who apply. You know, there's so much stuff. In a way, I think it's exciting because there's conversations going on about this that aren't going on at the Georgetown Law School faculty lounge. They're going on everywhere. And as horrific as we've seen events over the last couple of years with respect to these issues, they have sparked a conversation. Our greatest traditions as Americans are about this, about getting rid of this. I mean, that's why Abraham Lincoln is revered. And I will say also, you know, as immigrants, I mean, one of the great things that immigrants like my parents did was come here because they thought this country's basically a pretty fair one, not perfect, but pretty good. And, you know, that's been my experience. Like my, you know, I didn't know, my parents knew no lawyers. They cried when I went to law school, you know, and by just dint of hard work, I was able to do some things, which I don't think I would have been able to do in a lot of other countries. I don't think that's true if I would have been African-American. I think it would have been a whole series of subtle discriminations I would have faced. And not to say I didn't face some, but a whole series of other ones. Different folks face different sets of things. Right now, I'm very worried about the violence going on in the Asian American, to the Asian American community. That's just different than other types of violence. And I want to think about that, draw attention to it, and ultimately combat it.
when you talk about the affirmative action issues in colleges, and you talk about the Asian American community, and certainly I'm seeing this happen right now with all the attention on hate crimes against Asian Americans. There is a particular way in which white supremacy, America's racism, I say white supremacy, will pit black people against Asian Americans and sort of say that there's only a certain number of rights to go around or a certain number, certain amount of attention to go around, so we need to fight each other for it instead of actually recognizing that the system is unjust. So I would imagine that you maybe during, when talking about affirmative action, that you've talked to Asian Americans who are critical of affirmative action because they think it will stop them from getting opportunities.
Sure. I mean, it's the British strategy with, you know, with Pakistan, man. It's divide and conquer. And it was wrong then, and it's wrong now. The truth is that we've got a lot to learn from one another, and we have to understand that something like affirmative action is really important, not just for African Americans or Latinas, but absolutely for Asian Americans as well. I mean, I just think of the experiences I had. I was so privileged to go to the colleges and law school I did, because that's where I got to meet people from all different walks of life, and it totally changed my world. And that's what affirmative action at its best is about. It's not a zero-sum game in which you're trying to trade off some slots for another. You're trying to make the best setting possible for everyone.
It frustrates the hell out of me for some of the reasons Kamau said. I mean, I think we just had Vijay Prashad on, who, of course, wrote the book The Karma of Brahm Folk, and he talks about the idea of Asians and South Asians kind of being used as a weapon against black people. And, you know, what's happening with this affirmative action case, to me, is like the example of that. And it also is frustrating because it's like Edward Blum tried this with Abigail Fisher and the, you know, University of Texas Austin case, and that did not work out the way he wanted it to work out. And so he found a new strategy. And I know you can't say anything, so I know I'm just putting this out there, just how frustrating it is. We're being played. We're being played, and that's.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying. I'm not going to comment on it specifically, but I will say, when you talk about being played, there's another piece of this too, which is the political power of the Asian American community is just, it's non-existent. It's very weak. I mean, hopefully that'll start to change with the vice president and so on. But, you know, I look at what's happening to Neera Tanden, President Biden's nominee for the Office of Management and Budget. I look at what's happening to Vinita Gupta, who's nominated to be the number three person in the Justice Department. They don't have the same constituencies that will fight and go to war for them the way that others do. And so they're left a little bit in the lurch, and it's heartbreaking to see.
You strike me as an optimistic person. Would you say that's true? I mean, I feel like you're...
Totally.
You're okay. So... is it hard to be optimistic? And this is sort of a pivot to the where this country goes, because I feel like I've tried to be an optimistic person. I feel like optimism is important, but hard work has to back it up. And you're clearly doing a lot of hard work. But, you know, I was doing research for this interview, and I pulled up a clip where you were on Stephen Colbert talking about the Mueller report. And there was sort of a lot of excitement at that point of like, this is it. Like, once this comes out, Trump is done. Obviously, that didn't happen. And then when lots of other things happened, but then January 6th happened, you go, okay, this has to be it. Not you, but I'm saying there's a feeling of like he ordered an attack on his own government and didn't even, like, he told people to go attack and then he went the other direction. Like, you know, so like this has to be it. But there seems to be no it. there seems to be no moment that justice actually happens in a way that feels like finally this country is defining itself as a place that is just. Even about major things like a president ordering an attack on his own government.
Yeah, I totally appreciate that. I mean, the book is not yet closed on all this stuff. And, you know, Trump comes up and the Republican Party come up with shenanigan after shenanigan to evade justice. But I will say, I do think that the Mueller report will matter. I do think January 6th will matter. I do think that Trump is now facing, for example, a metastasis of investigations against him. So you've got federal investigations, maybe continued Mueller report stuff. You've got individual number one. You've got all that. You have state investigations going on in New York. They just got his tax returns. You've got Georgia investigating him for election interference. You have the possibility of this new January 6th commission, which might have criminal referral power. You possibly have 14th Amendment, you know, exclude him from Congress things going on. And you've got a wealth of stuff. And yeah, none of it threw him in jail while he was in office. I mean, he had enabler after enabler to protect him. But I do think the record may come out and Americans may pay attention to it. Not everyone. They may still have his hardcore 30% or whatever. But this legacy is at this point indelible. I mean, he will go down as the worst president ever in American history.
I'm just worried that the Democrats or whoever is working that on those criminal charges are about to file them. Like, we're about to go get him. And then he's going to, then something's going to be like, oh, it's January 20th. And he's the president. We can't do it again. Like, I'm just worried that, like, that the moment that it happens, people have already.
I don't think you need to be much of an optimist to say Donald Trump is never going to be president again. I mean,
okay. All right.
I mean, in fact, I don't think he even wants it. He may want to run for president so he can steal people's money and, you know, divert it to whatever.
Well, also to keep himself free of criminal prosecution, he may be like, I should just be president again just so I can. He's using it as a witness protection program.
How aggressive do you think Merrick Garland is going to be in his prosecution of the folks involved with the January 6th Capitol attack?
Garland is the most by the book, you know, individual in D.C. I mean, really. I mean, there is no one who's like a straighter arrow. And that's actually good for these prosecutions. I mean, these prosecutions just require, they don't need to be, you know, politicized or like lock them up or any of that. It's literally just, here's what you did. Here's what the law is. Tell that to a jury. Go home. Okay. So these are not hard prosecutions. And so we should welcome that. The harder stuff comes when you start to think, as I suspect there is going to be evidence that high level Trump people, perhaps Trump himself, did some nefarious stuff that we probably don't know about yet. Very hard thing to go indict the last president. I mean, that's, you know, what happens in despotic regimes, not in the United States in general. But we had a president who was so fundamentally aberrational and put into power such aberrational people. I don't think the old American rule book should necessarily apply here. So if the facts show that Trump or his cabinet or White House advisors committed crimes, I have no doubt that Merrick Garland will indict. I just think it's going to be totally by the book.
So you're also saying it's going to be easier to get the low-level dealers, but not necessarily the supplier or the kingpin?
Well, the low-level dealers, we have them on video, right? I mean, right. You know, we have them all bragging about taking the seal and, you know, whatever else, you know, horrible things they did. You know, yeah. Trump ran everything like a mafia boss. I mean, your drug analogy is exactly right. You know,
I just saw The Wire again, so this is.
Yeah. Okay. No, he'll talk out of both sides of his mouth. He'll use, like, in his January 6th, peaceful once. You know, everyone knows what he is really saying. And they, you know, we have the video to show that's how they took it, you know, to go and invade the Capitol. But, you know, he always lays it down with some sort of defense and often with a middle cutout or something like that. I mean, it's standard mob tactics.
Neil, thank you so much for being on Politically Reactive. I was so psyched when we got you booked for the show. And it honestly, like, this has been great.
Thank you so much. A really pleasure to be with both of you.
Neil Katyal is Saunders Professor at the Georgetown Law School and former acting Solicitor General of the United States.
Neil is the author of Impeach, the case against Donald Trump. He also has a great TED Talk where he walks through the case he made against Guantanamo to the Supreme Court and how the techniques he used can be helpful in winning any argument. You can find the link in the show notes.
And when we come back, we'll talk to comedian and writer Amber Ruffin and her sister, Lacey Lamar, about their new book of crazy everyday stories of racism in Omaha, Nebraska, called You Won't Believe What Happened to Lacey.
Amber Ruffin is a comedian, writer, and actress.
She started doing theater and improv in her hometown of Omaha, Nebraska, before a stint at the improv comedy troupe Boom Chicago in Amsterdam.
When she returned to the U.S., she performed at Second City and met Jenny Hagel. Together, they became writers for Late Night with Seth Meyers and became known for their reoccurring segment, Jokes Seth Can't Tell.
Esquire magazine recently featured a profile on the hardships of growing up white, middle class, and male.
Said black people, ooh, fiction.
According According to new data, American women are now more educated than ever.
And if they get just a little smarter, they'll stop dating men.
Now Amber is the host, and Jenny is head writer, of The Amber Ruffin Show on the streaming network Peacock, and which is now in its second week on NBC, the broadcast network.
Meanwhile, Amber's sister Lacey Lamar was still in Omaha, Nebraska, living and working and dealing with the everyday racism of being black in America. Huh, I wonder what that's like. Oh, but she was also, again, in Omaha, Nebraska.
Their conversations about Lacey's experiences are at the heart of the new book they've written together, You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism.
Let's get Amber and Lacey in here.
Amber and Lacey, thank you. I feel like you both are so much more fun than we are. Are you feeling that right now? I just feel, and I know that we do this every week, and but I don't think we're not loose enough.
I think you guys are pretty fun.
Pretty, what you're getting is the vibe that they don't need us.
Lacey don't need nobody, and that's for dang sure.
Well, I'm really glad that we're doing this interview. Amber, I've loved your work for such a long time, and it's so fun to see your career like elevate and get so big, and you have your own show now. Lacey, do you still live in Nebraska? And also, why?
Oh, no. I still live in Nebraska because my daughter's here, my parents are here, I still have siblings. And even though, you know, if you read the book, you'll read some really horrible things that have happened to me, but I'm still in a close-knit community. I live in Benson, and that is just my place. There are black people here, so I live in a black community. And so I can escape from all that when I need to. And I may or may not move. Amber's like, you need to come to New York. So who knows?
So talk about this. Amber could just come to you and be like, I'm writing a book about you. I just need you to sign these forms right here so I can take your stories. That's what happened. How did this come together? That you specifically would be a part of the book, not just the subject of the book.
So it's always been this running joke, this thing that we would always say, you know, when something happened to me, it would, you know, friends and family would be like, that's going in the book. You know, Amber would be like, oh, that's part of chapter 12. It was just this joke. We've always said we need to write a book. And then one day Amber came to me and she was like, we're going to do it. We're going to write a book. And I'm like, oh, okay. And a lot of it came from journals that I would keep when you're a black person at work and you work in
you
the
You need to write down all the slights in case you're building a case.
This is so funny that now I'm meeting a lot of people that don't do this. I thought this was a normal damn thing. I thought this was a thing. It's not a thing. I just found this out. But I would write it down. You know, oh, so-and-so called me, you know, Negro today. And, you know, and I would write stuff down as people were being racist to me at work. I'd be like, oh, okay. All right. You're saying.
I tried to write a racism journal once. And initially it was kind of cathartic. Okay. I'm getting it out. I remember it just depressed me because then I could actually see it all together, and it was harder to move. Granted, it was only a few years after 9/11, so I probably shouldn't have done it then. But
might have been some extenuating circumstances.
There were some. I could have waited a few more years.
Maybe you should have taken up surfing or skiing in that moment.
But like, how? I mean, did it ever hurt to write all that stuff down? Because it just seems like once you put it on paper, it feels even more permanent in a way, right?
Not for me. I was writing it down just so I could be like, I got to go to Sally, HR, and I need to have my story straight. Like, that's really why you're laughing. But I wrote this so that when I go to HR to file my complaints, I can say, Steve said this at 8:32 in the meeting, and Kelly, Bill, and Marvin were all present. Like, and so if you need to go and ask them, this is like, I took some serious notes. Wow. And so that's why I did it. I wasn't doing this to be like, later I'm going to write a book. So then when Amber was like, let's write the book, I was like, oh, let me go get my journals because I got some stories in there. And it was just like stacks and stacks of journals. And that's how we kind of wrote.
So you'd already written the book, basically.
The book was in the journals.
I mean, whose idea was it to write a book?
Lacey texted me on the way to a meeting with the book guy. And I was like, I am not in danger of writing a book. I'm never going to do that. I'd rather not go to this meeting. They kind of insisted that I do it. So then, but Lacey texted me on the way and I was like, Lacey has a million of these stories. What if we just put only the funny ones in a book. And the guy was like, there's enough for, yes. Yes. There's definitely, there's enough for any, there, each category has enough of just the funny ones. If we had to write down every book, it'd be longer than the Bible. It'd be a longer
What was the editing process like, especially when, you know, these stories are so personal and they happen to you? Did you have an, did the person understand your experiences or give you the freedom to, like, were the people you're working with actually working with you and not trying to take away from your experiences?
We chose the editor who was like, I will not say anything. You can do whatever you want. I am not going to stop you. I may suggest something, maybe, but other than that, you're free to do whatever you want. I was like, you. Because she said once, she said, you can't have the story in there because even though, she didn't say you can't, she said you should consider taking the story out because the guy you're talking about is so old, it seems like he's senile and not racist. And I was like, oh, okay. Also, it was like a crazy story. It was the hardest to believe story. Yeah, he was definitely racist. 100%, but, okay.
But yeah.
And then there was one, we included a chapter about our sister Angie, and her stories were too rough.
They were so depressing. They were bad.
They were a little horrid. But I was like, hey, come on. She was like, I don't think you can come back from these stories. I was like, okay.
Like, horrid, I mean, like, not funny, just really disturbing.
Just or really sad.
like the regular racism.
In your I'm laughing, but it's just regular racism.
Like the kind that does get you to protest or march or
for
get
sure,
your family to airbrush your face on a t-shirt. That kind of regular racism.
Yes.
So I feel like we, for the purpose of the listeners, because certainly, I mean, the book is great and it's hilarious, but I would like to have the listeners have, what would you say, and this can be to both of you, but certainly Lacey, since you're still there, some classic Nebraska racism. This is the kind of racism that Nebraska does, because I feel like every part of the country has their own, mwah, like, you know, a little bit of racism. What would you say is some classic Nebraska? It could be in the book or not in the book.
Oh, classic Nebraska racism is when I walk into a store and there is no help. In fact, they will run away from you, but yet you just wait. You wait like 2 seconds and then a white person walks into the door and 10 people, hi, can I help you? You know, that happens. That will continue to happen. That will never end. Poor customer service. Just going places. That's why when people are like, let's go to this restaurant. And I go, well, where is it? Because it's a certain, I'm tired. I don't want to deal with hi and having to be overly friendly so that you get the help. I just want to walk into a place, get my service. And I went to pick my car up somewhere and it was out of my zone. But I went and got some stuff done. I drive a Mini Cooper, a bright red Mini Cooper. So it's not like there was a ton of them in the parking lot. And in fact, mine was the only one. I went to pick it up that morning. And I walk in and there's a lady in front of me. She's grabbing her car. And I watched how she did it. It's a white woman. She goes, hell yeah, my car's ready. It's just right out here. It's the blue Buick, whatever. And they go, oh yeah. And they take the keys and they hand them to her. And that was it. So I was like, this is going to be easy. Because everything's paid for. I did this all, you know. So I go and I go, hi, yeah, that's my Mini Cooper. Right there. My name's Lacey Lamar. Can you? The guy goes, what? And he goes, that's your car. And he goes, hold on a second. And I go, oh, no, no, no. And so he's on the computer. He goes, I don't see it. And he goes, did you come here? I go, that's my, so right, that's what you get. You got to be ready. You have to be. So in that moment, I could have went full on crazy, but I did, you know, I want to go to jail. I want to get shot out here. So I had to just sit there. He went and got a manager. The manager came over and you're just like, so then I pull out my driver's license and I'm like, I am Lacey Lamar and that is my car. Like, it was just too much. And there were two white people sitting, waiting for their cars to get. And I turned and looked at them and I said, do you see what I'm going through here? Do you see? And they were just like, what's happening?
Yeah. It's up.
So that's Omaha. New York was great. When I was in New York, I was living it up, walking down the street. Nobody was walking following down the street.
That's living it up.
No, I was telling Amber, we were in a store and I had this huge purse and she was making fun of me. And I went to put my hand in the purse and I was like, oh no, because they're going to think I'm stealing something. Like that is a thing. So then I took my hand out and I go, and I told Amber, I didn't want to put my hand in this purse. She's like, they don't care about you. They don't. No one's looking at you. There's literally black people everywhere. And I was like, you're right. I'm going to dig in this purse as much as I want to. Like, that's sad that I literally was like froze up. Like, okay, don't make any more movements. I can only put my hand in my purse so many times before someone comes over and asks, did I steal something? So that's a thing.
The three of us, not including Hari in this because he's the Eeyore of comedy, so this doesn't include you. But the three of us have something in common that I, from reading about the book and reading about the two of you and knowing how people reflect to me, that because our outside exteriors are generally trying to be very upbeat and cheery, that therefore, when we talk about racism, sometimes it's not taken that seriously because we're upbeat and cheery. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, for sure. If you got a smile on, people try to get you. It's just like... They want to, take the highway to the danger zone. They want to dip a little toe in it and see how it goes. And we create a safe space for people to explore their racist tendencies. It'll get your ass in a book.
And names may not be changed to protect the guilty.
May or may not.
Can you speak to that too, Lacey, about how that is for you? Because, I mean, you're working, like, you know, Amber's in New York, so she's surrounded by lots of people of color, lots of different types of folks, But a lot of the stories are about your workspace and how you fit in there or don't fit in there and how your outward demeanor doesn't let people know that you're actually taking all this seriously.
Yeah, well, it would not matter if I was, you know, because when I'm in these meetings, I'm just like this, you know, I'm not super giggly, overly bubbly or anything. It does not matter what mood I am or what, it just gets said to me. And we still don't know why. The study needs to be done. I have strangers that just come up out of the blue and say things to me. And Amber's always like, it's because you're small and little and, you know, and maybe that is, maybe it's my size. I don't know, but it's never... It could be when I'm in a good mood. It could be when I'm in a bad mood. But it's Omaha, Nebraska. So they are just going to say whatever. This is a whole nother world. I'm not kidding. Come visit. It's a whole other world.
Well, you're really painting a great picture.
I know. Poor Omaha.
No. I mean, luckily for me, I travel around a lot. I go to a lot of places where that's a story where, like, this is where I live and I love it. Also, that guy screwed up. I hate him. Don't go to that side of town.
Definitely.
Don't try to get a job there. You know, don't go to that bank. You know, so I I was kicked out of a coffee shop in Berkeley, so I know how I know the score.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, this book, I basically could have submitted that story to this book. I feel like a lot of the times people don't take the sort of the, what we call, now the word is microaggressions, basically for racism that doesn't kill you. But just the idea that, like, the sort of the death by a thousand racist cuts that happens when you're just sort of always taking in just like little tiny, like little pieces of racism. And I think it's really important that a book like that is out here to say that this stuff hurts too. It ain't all got to be something that warrants a protest in the street to affect you.
Yeah, because it's just a buildup over and over and over. And I get it when people want to say microaggression, but like the 100th microaggression is what stabs you and what makes you want to flip a table. I just don't like the term. I don't, because I would have like 20 microaggressions in an hour. You know, it's like, you know, when those microaggressions turn into a macroaggression, like, I don't know. I don't love that term.
Are there people who have read the book and then called and said, I'm sorry, I didn't know that affected you. Now I'm in this book. Like, are there people who discovered
can we take it
up?
Back? Can we edit it? Can we?
Okay, so the people have called me and been like, oh my goodness, you know, coworkers, and said, like, I didn't know all this was going on. I mean, even though you said it, I just didn't, once I could see it in the book, okay, yeah, I understand. And then I would get some apologies. But the funniest one was a lady who called me and she said, oh, Lacey, I just read your book. And, you know, I was reading this one part and I thought it was me, but then I realized it wasn't. And I said, oh, no, that was you. You're in there. You did that.
Wow. Well, what What happens, like, what is the vibe like at work now? Like, does everybody look down at their feet when you walk into the room?
I am no longer there.
Yay!
Yay, I'm no longer there. And I do call in and check with some people, though. I'm like, what's going on? And they're like, oh, your book is on my desk. And so they said, people are nervous. That's what the last messages I got. People, I don't mention, like, there's no real names. There's no, mm-hmm. we don't name the place, you know, or the business or anything, but they know.
So now black people are walking around your job with like the book in their, like in their, like in their belt, like just sort of pulling up their shirt.
Say something.
Could you talk to us about Nancy, the HR person that you had experience with who was racist? Uh-oh. Like you
just,
what?
You just took her back. You just took her back.
It was her name actually Nancy? Because Nancy's like
the
perfect name.
All of the names. Her real
Nancy's
name.
Nancy's a pretty good name.
Her real name's even better. But no, Nancy. We can't. Stop. Okay. So Nancy was an HR lady who just, and actually, I say she followed me, but she didn't. I went from one job to the next, and she followed me. And she was at the next job that I went to. So I couldn't get away from Nancy. Omaha small. My one story about Nancy was we had hired an intern. I was at this great corporate job. I told Amber, oh my God, I made this job. It's my dream job. I love this job. And the building was a complete circle. Nancy was taking a 18-year-old white intern around just to everyone's office to introduce them. So I can hear the intern coming down the hall with Nancy. They get to my door. They introduce me. I chit-chat with her. Oh, what high school did you go to? Blah, 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 blah. She came in my office. We talked for a little bit and left. An hour later, I get a call from the HR lady and the CEO, and they bring me in, and there's six people in the room, and they're like, we heard that you were very rude when you were introduced to the intern. And I was also had a lady with me who was like my assistant, and she was Hispanic, and she immediately starts to tear up. And I go, no. I said, you didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. And they were like, yeah, we heard that you just kind of like rolled your eyes. You put your head down. You didn't. And I said, nope, that didn't happen. And also when they brought us into this room, just imagine this huge office, you know, this huge corner office. Everyone is sitting up in these chairs, kind of like a chair that I'm in. They put us on this low ass bench. It was so tiny and low that our butts were touching. So just think about how low this bench was and how tiny it was. And they did that on purpose to like intimidate us. They spoke to us for 41 minutes. And Lacey, what do you think you could have done better? And do you need training on how? I'm a grown ass woman. And you asked me if I need training on how to greet someone. And that story is the one that stings the most. Like when I'm looking through the book, that just happened to me. That's like not 5 years ago. That was like one of the last racist things that happened to me. So when I read that, I'm like, ooh, you know, it's so like 1952, but it just happened.
Wait, so after that happened, did you walk out and say, I'm going to write a book?
The book was already being written. The book was already being written when that happened. It just got added. And right. I actually went to my desk and I cleaned everything out, and I was going to New York because I came back, told them off, you know, it's in the book. I just told them, you know, this didn't happen, blah, blah, blah. You know, you guys are lying, whatever. And then I went to my desk, cleaned it out. And when I went to New York, I told Amber, yeah, I'm getting fired from that corporate job. they don't like me. I'm going to be out. And when I came back, the day I came back, they fired me. And I called Amber, I don't have a job.
Wow. So in the meeting, you told them what the truth was.
Yes, and I had my notebook. And it's so funny. I was writing this down, and the lady says to me, why are you always put that notebook down. Why are you always writing stuff? And I'm like, why are you always writing? Don't tell me. I'm a grown-ass woman. Don't tell me I can't take notes. You're the one saying it, so it deserves to be documented.
That is so beautiful. Why are you always writing stuff? Oh, my God. I think that people just don't. I think people of color get this. But your average everyday, even your white ally, your white person, you're the white, what can I do people? What can I do? they don't understand how exhausting this kind of racism is. And like a story like you told about your car in the parking lot, that sticks with you for weeks. You have like flashbacks of that story. Like you can't just sort of go, anyway, that without a book like this, it's just a story. Eventually just becomes, why is grandma always so mad?
Exactly. And that one to me isn't really that funny. It's not like the other ones Amber and I have told 80 billion times and we have laughed and laughed and laughed about it. So the sting is like gone from them. Like we tell them all the time.
That Nancy one just stings because it is the end of a long circle. Like she already had her own dang chapter and then came back to another job and then got her fired a second time. It's amazing. So like it had to go in the book.
It had to be hard not to use her real name.
It did. But you know what? I just need to add this. And Amber, I think Amber, I am speaking in November at an HR like convention here in Omaha.
Oh my God.
Nancy's gonna be there.
Oh yay.
So Amber, you have to. I don't care what you're doing. If you're making a movie, if you're flying to Mars, you have to be on that call.
I really got to. I gotta see it. I'm a pin that bitch.
Amber, I want to ask you a few questions about, you are in that category of black folks who, and I'm in this category too, who last year was rough on us as a people, but professionally that roughness gave us more opportunities. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Of course you do. I live in that dichotomy of like, yay, racism so bad that people want to give me more opportunities. And yet you try to figure out, how do I navigate this so I'm not just that black person on the hill, as Damon Wayans did in one of his stand-up specials. When they ask you, is racism bad? You go, well, now that I got these $15 million, it's pretty good. You know what I mean? Like, how do you navigate that?
I feel like white guilt has played a role in my success, possibly. Like, the white guilt of NBC as a whole, just being like, we could use some more color. I don't know. I don't feel that bad about it because I do like to use it as I like to use the shows as an opportunity to talk about, you know, racism so that I can work through it as like therapy. And it's great. So that specific element of it does make me feel guilty for sure. Because at the beginning of a script, it's bothering me. But then by the end, I'm like, you know, and that's why redlining sucks. Feels great. Knots in your back start to release a little bit. Put your feet up and watch the new Superman and Lois.
I love the fact that your TV show, which is on Peacock and is going to get to be on broadcast NBC, has such a diverse isn't even the word. You have like a black writer's room. And that is such an incredible thing because I used to write on a TV show called Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell.
Yay, I love that show.
It was such a good show. And our writer's room, like, was full of different, like, people of color.
It was diverse. It was not black.
It was a diverse room. But it certainly was, like, it was a lot more freer. Like, the older white writers that were there were great, but would say things like, yeah, this is not how because a lot of us were new to writer's rooms. And they'd say stuff like, yeah, this isn't how it normally works. Normally, we don't have a 10-minute conversation about whether that's racist or not. Like, that's not a thing that happens. And, you know, it was incredibly freeing. And you've worked at this point in a number of different writer's rooms. What does yours feel like?
It is a lot of talking because Jenny and I are the adults. Jenny is a Puerto Rican lesbian. And I'm a black lady. And then 90% of our writer's room is black. Half of us are gay. And there's one straight cis white guy. Just surviving.
Do you make sure he knows that he's on the fence after every quarter?
I should. I'm so bad to that guy. I love him so much. But hey, look, you knew what you were getting into, man. We're going to sing the Black National Anthem to open today's pitch meeting. We're like 1 second away from that. But it's mostly like, freaking, hey, how's it going? It's 10 minutes. Because I have to know. Because we're both like, Jenny and I like miss being in the writer's room and knowing everyone's business and talking to you about your dog. You know, did your child like the sneakers you got them? I need to know these things. So like we do a fair bit of yapping. I mean, it's probably more than a male-led writer's room would allow. But then we do spend a lot of time, like sometimes when things are heavy, we will just talk about them. You know, when there is a police shooting or when a cop is found innocent of murder, then we will have to spend some time just talking about it and how furious we are. And then sometimes a bit comes out of it, but sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, sometimes people are like, ugh, today's tough. And I'm like, it is tough. It's tough out here. If ever you need to just stay at home, we all been at home, just keep your computer off, do that and let's survive. Come up with some ideas tomorrow. We're fine. So it's really like a bunch of hippies, you know. I imagine if we were in person, we'd all be sitting cross-legged on the floor, passing around a stick, talking about our feelings. It's pretty touchy-feely.
So your whole process of your TV show has been through COVID, huh?
That's right.
That's got to be a real, like when you're working your way through showbiz and go, one day I'm going to get my own TV show. You didn't picture this, right? It's got to be hard.
I wished on a monkey's paw. Why all of this has happened.
If only Wonder Woman 84 had come out before, you would have known.
I shouldn't have done it. Oh my gosh. It is exactly what I dreamed of, except completely upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I'll take it. Not going to catch me complaining. It's great.
That's the key thing. I feel that way all the time. Like, this is harder than I thought it would be. It ain't as hard as it could be.
I know that's right. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Could be Lacey job hard.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Lacey job is a degree of hard. And it's yeah,
it ain't Omaha. It ain't Omaha, Nebraska. Did you steal your own car hard? It ain't that hard. I asked Amber about the last year. You live in a place that, especially last year, had to be, the streets had to be hot for you and for Black folks out there. What was it? What was 2020 like in Nebraska?
When Trump was elected, I was done going. What we say is out west. That's code for white people. So when someone says, do you want to go to this restaurant? I go, is it out west? I don't do that. That's where my car was. I felt it. I felt it hard. When Trump was elected, it totally shut down my circle. Because I was always like, oh, I'll go to this new fancy restaurant here. Mm-mm. I hunkered down, stayed in my little neighborhood. And I'm still like that. Just because we still have our Trump flags up. People are still rooting for him. And I just won't, like, I'm in this smaller circle now, and you can feel it. Trumpers aren't taking down their signs and not wearing their hats and their T-shirts. For some reason, they're not letting that go. So it is, you can feel really uncomfortable real quick if you go to certain areas. So I just try to stay in my little circle, enjoy the hell out of my life where I'm at, but I'm not venturing out.
I have to tell a story. Maybe it was 2018 when I went to visit Lacey in Omaha. I was like, let's go sing karaoke. She's like, great. I'm like, it's a Tuesday night. I don't know where there's karaoke. And I go, oh, there's karaoke at this one place. And Lacey's like, there is no way two Black women are going to that place. They're like, we're absolutely going. It's karaoke. Who cares? She's like, we cannot go there. It's not safe. I go, it's white people. What are they going to do? So I call everyone to go there. Hey, we're meeting up at the spot. None of the black people show up. All the white people show up. Lacey is like, there's a reason why this happened. I have to go with you because I don't want you to die. Lacey, me, and all our white friends are at this karaoke place, and it's fine. We're having fun. We get up, we sing songs. White people are like, hey, and we're like, eh. They're like, you sang a good song. All right. The night goes on. The white people drink more. They feel more free to talk to us. They start like being like, hey, girlfriend. Yeah, you know, you got junk in your trunk and like stuff like that. So we're like, ooh, this is getting a little uncomfortable. And Lacey's like, maybe we should just leave. I'm like, no, I think it's fine. And this is this really happened. At this point, a giant bus pulls up out front. A bunch of children, very young kids, come in. They all have on a hat and a shirt. And they both say, make America great again, Trump. And it was 30 of these kids. I was like, you have to be kidding me. Lacey was like, I told you we can't go into this place. It's the worst.
So, I don't do it.
So we left. We paid our tab, but we left.
Man.
I like the fact the whole time you were telling the story, Lacey was just nodding her head, no. Just like, yeah. Still, you're still mad about that. You're still not feeling it.
All that bitterness. My baby sister does not listen.
I wasted a whole night of karaoke.
That's what baby sisters do.
I was trying to figure out how it could get worse. I'm like, and then the Hitler Youth showed up.
Yeah, and she didn't want to. They didn't want to find out how much worse it got, so they left. They didn't want to find out. Could it get worse than this? Well, let's just go and not find out. No. Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the podcast today. We really appreciate it. Love your book. Super happy to have these types of stories told in the world at a time when I think a lot of white people think that they can only hear the hashtag ones. So I think it's important to expand those narratives and talk about all the breadth of racism. Amber, super excited for your success. Super excited for your show on Peacock. And Lacey, I look forward to your talk show. You already got the set.
Tune in next week.
You guys, thank you for having us. We love you so bad. Much.
Thank you.
Amber Ruffin is the host of The Amber Ruffin Show, which streams on Peacock and is now on Fridays late night on NBC.
Lacey Lamar is her sister, and together they're the authors of You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism. That's it for this week. Thanks to Neil Katyal, Amber Ruffin, and Lacey Lamar. Special thanks to Paul B. Allen for engineering for Lacey in North Omaha. I see you out there.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525. 917-477-6525. And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
And rate and review the show wherever you get your podcast. It gets the word out, and yes, we do read them, including the mean ones! And also, my mom is the special guest on Dear Prudence with Danny Lavery for last week. So you should find that podcast, download it, and listen to it.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And Hari Kundabolu.
And W. Kamau Bell.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger-Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.